This week on Making Contact.
The immediate thing he did was spray me in the eyes with pepper spray. And then he proceeded to grab my head and stuff the pepper spray canister in my mouth.
They pepper sprayed me 3 times, and, you know, the 3rd time was definitely the worst. It was just this really intense burning feeling on my face. And also, I couldn't breathe.
Pepper spray has been linked to numerous deaths in the United States. In some cases, people have died in police custody after being subjected to the burning chemical agent, sparking outrage from victims' families and communities. And there's been a growing use of pepper spray against social activists as a means of intimidation. On this program, we take a look at how police have used pepper spray during demonstrations and some broader implications. I'm Philip Babbitt, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. On October 16th, 1997, a group of environmental activists sat around a tree stump they had brought into the office of then-Congressman Frank Riggs, Republican representative from a North Coast district in California. Environmentalists have viewed Riggs as a friend of the timber industry, which has logged tens of thousands of acres of old-growth forests. Activism has intensified around this issue over the past decade. Committed to their civil disobedience action, the protesters stood their ground in Riggs's office as Humboldt County Sheriff Department officers used cotton swabs and gauze to directly apply pepper spray to their eyes.
You failed to do release. I'm going to use chemical agents to try to get you off.
Well, we're going to fight it in court that it's not a right thing for people to be using chemical weapons on other people. You know, it's not right.
I'm not going to argue with you. I'm going to start this process. What you were given was a little bit of pepper spray with a Q-tip. What we're going to do now is an actual spray. Okay. Who's going to release? Are you going to release? Are you going to release?
This is audio from a police videotape of the incident. The Headwaters Action Video Collective produced a video using these and other excerpts for a production called Fire in the Eyes, which documents charges of police brutality and excessive use of pepper spray.
And they started pulling my head back, and I realized with horror that they were going to put it directly onto our eyes. And I never heard of that.
Are you going to release?
I'm not good.
A second incident, which took place at the headquarters of a prominent timber company, Pacific Lumber, was investigated by Amnesty International. According to the Human Rights Organization's report, 2 women were swabbed in the eyes with liquid pepper spray, and a 3rd woman was sprayed in the eyes at close range.
I could hear Molly crying or scream crying, and I just wanted to unlock and, you know, help them.
In its report, Amnesty International said that, quote, in this instance, the spray was clearly abusive as it was not used to protect officers or others, but was applied in a calculated and deliberate way to inflict pain as a way of gaining compliance in cases of demonstrators who posed no threat. The U.S. Postal Service was the first to use pepper spray as a dog repellent in the 1980s. The product eventually made its way to police departments. Since pepper spray was introduced in the United States, it has been involved in at least 60 deaths, according to the publication Covert Action Quarterly. In recent years, labor, environmental, and peace activists have been pepper sprayed while engaged in nonviolent direct actions or other protests. Striking workers at the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, for example, were repeatedly blasted inches away with the burning agent, which is 600 times more intense than cayenne pepper. They've been striking the newspapers owned by Gannett and Knight Ridder since 1995. At the height of the strike, police frequently pepper sprayed and tear gassed picketing workers. A local television station covered the strike extensively and was there during a confrontation in 1996.
They just started spraying. I was getting ready to sit down and they started spraying. I couldn't breathe. I still can't see.
Incapacitate you. And that's what they're trying to do with the union voice in this country.
I did nothing to provoke them. I was sitting there and I got sprayed directly in my eyes.
Well, we were just standing on the line and the police, I guess, felt it was too close to him, and they started pushing with the sticks. And one of them pushed at me, and I just put my hand up like that, and before I could tell anything, another one, a big guy, leaned over with the mace and shot me right in the face, in fact, almost directly in the eyes from less than a foot away.
I'm here to support my union. I've been a member of this local for 20 years, and I'm not leaving.
What do you think the police are doing here?
Making absolute fools of themselves, showing that they're bought up by this town and this company.
Are you prepared to get maced today if they do anything to you?
I wasn't prepared for it, but I lived through it. I guess I can live through it again.
You did get sprayed earlier?
Yes, I did.
What did it feel like?
Like I was on fire. I've been through it before. I was in the service. I'm a vet. Locked out vet. They got a lot of appreciation, don't they?
What do you think of what the police are doing here?
Only their job. Whatever corporate greed tell them to do, that's what they're doing.
In September 1998, the National Labor Relations Board charged Gannett and Knight Ritter with violating 9 labor laws and illegally provoking a strike. They were ordered to reinstate the union workers. Currently, the workers are still locked out while the board reviews the company's appeals. A small percentage of striking workers have returned to their jobs, some with pay cut in half, others with full-time reduced to part-time. Incidentally, the Detroit newspaper agency made payments as donations to the city of Sterling Heights, Michigan, where Gannett and Knight Ritter's main production plant is located. The city accepted the money to cover expenses for equipment and supplies used by local law enforcement during the strike, including pepper spray. There have been several other pepper spray incidents involving union members, including the dousing of strikers at the Staley plant in Decatur, Illinois. Another example of excessive use of pepper spray occurred on Columbus Day, 1997. It was the 28th National Day of Mourning, a Native American event that takes place at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts, lamenting the so-called discovery of America and the loss of countless Native American lives.
I think a lot of you must have seen when you came in this morning that the state cops surrounding Plymouth Rock. They brought out about 60 state troopers today to protect Plymouth Rock. What we are going to do is we're going to form up now, for those of you who wish to join us, behind this orange banner that says, "We are not vanishing. We are not conquered. We are as strong as ever."
Native Americans and supporters marched peacefully, but police insisted that the demonstrators halt their procession. When members of the march chose to proceed rather than stop, the police sprayed them with pepper spray.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program can now be heard across the United States and Canada, South Africa, and around the world on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. You can also hear us on the Internet. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tape and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736. We also welcome comments and suggestions for future programs.
Police departments and federal law enforcement authorities have used a variety of chemical sprays for years. The first was tear gas, a compound formulated by Smith & Wesson called CN, an acronym for its chemical composition. It was rarely made available to the public. Another version of tear gas is known as CS, also an acronym. It's stronger than CN, which causes a sharp burning sensation and lasts about half an hour. But CS takes a bit longer to cause a reaction. The most popular chemical spray on the market is OC, more commonly known as pepper spray. The agent is an inflammatory substance, not an irritant like CN and CS. It causes immediate dilation of capillaries in the eyes and other mucous membranes, according to sales literature. It results in temporary blindness and instant inflammation of the respiratory system, cutting off all but life support breathing. With effects like that, it would seem that pepper spray is extremely effective for police in stopping violent assailants. As it turns out, this is not the case. According to Phil Messina, director of Modern Warrior, a New York City-based law enforcement training organization that has performed independent tests on the effectiveness of pepper spray. He explains to Making Contact's Stephanie Welch that Modern Warrior tested whether people who were pepper sprayed could still accomplish an assigned task, such as walk through a series of obstacles and find the person who sprayed them. Messina begins by talking about why police departments switched from CN, tear gas, to OC, pepper spray.
When was OC spray introduced to law enforcement as a means for self-defense? How was it presented? Why did they decide to go ahead and use this spray?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the ineffectiveness of the CN. A lot of law enforcement people stopped using CN because they found it just didn't work against violent subjects. Basically, it didn't cause a lot of physical damage, but it was very unreliable as far as effectiveness went unless you used it in high concentrations. And there was concerns about using chemicals in high concentrations. And so a lot of companies went over to OC, which theoretically could, at the time, was believed it could be used in high concentrations without causing any long-term medical effects.
Now, you've done extensive testing on the effectiveness, like you said, in self-defense situations, that it's not so effective when a person has a goal or a goal-oriented. Could you talk a little bit about that and the conclusions that you came to from your testing?
Yeah, well, basically, when we saw the original experiments that were being done back in 1989, 1990, virtually all the experimentation was either being done by manufacturers or by the FBI. The FBI was the only non-manufacturer who was doing any experimentation on the effectiveness. And we had concerns about the passive way that these experiments were being done. We were concerned with the way the experiments on effectiveness were being carried out. So we carried out the first of what was called active experiments, where what we actually did is we gave the test subjects goals to accomplish before they were sprayed. And then we sprayed them. And the object was to see if they could accomplish those short-term and long-term goals after being sprayed. And what we found out is that in every case, our initial experiments were with 60. Now our last experiment brought us over 200 subjects. In every case, the subject has been able to carry out either a short-term or long-term goal.
I was sprayed twice. It went in. I know it went in because I felt it go in, and then I was sprayed again. And then I was told to complete my goal, and to tell you the truth, I had no problem completing my goal.
Jennifer Haas is executive director of the American Women's Self-Defense Association, based in New York. She participated in the Modern Warrior pepper spray tests.
And my goal was to find a person who had sprayed me, and we actually had a rubber knife, and I had to go to vital targets with that knife. And then I walked over to the decontamination center. I had a doctor interview me because at the time we were doing another experiment as to what works best to go through the decontamination process. I answered all his questions fine, and then I just walked over to a pool and I jumped in. If I was sprayed in a violent confrontation, it would not stop me. And I'm only 115 pounds and I'm 5'2".
How have some of the companies responded to the independent tests that you have put out, or the conclusions to your tests?
Well, the funny thing is, initially they requested the test. And then after one OC manufacturer requested the test. And then after we gave in our initial results, they didn't want to know us anymore because our initial results were exactly what I told you. We informed them that although we felt that OC was more effective than CN, that it still was not effective to the level where it would work against either violent or goal-oriented subjects. And our concern was that the law enforcement community was being told to use OC sprays on non-compliant subjects and to use higher levels of force on violent subjects because the OC was unlikely to work, and yet civilians were being given a weaker product and told that it would work on violent subjects. And this contradiction bothered us, and we made it very well known, so naturally it didn't put us on the best side of the OC and the chemical companies.
Talking about non-compliant victims, when the police in California swabbed and sprayed the eyes of activists who were restrained in order to force them to release the lock on their lockboxes, which held them down, few actually complied, and the police usually ended up cutting them out with the means that they had successfully used in the past, such as a saw or scissors. Now, do you know what sort of regulations exist that address the use of pepper spray by police on people who don't pose a violent threat?
Generally, most departments use OC spray at a level of force which is between verbalization, that's talking to the subject, and what they call hard, empty-handed tactics. OC spray is most generally used in between those two phases. So in other words, if you tell a subject to get out of the car, and the subject does not get out of the car, he's non-compliant. He's not violent. He's not even resistive. He's just non-compliant. At that point, before reaching in and doing what we would call a hard, empty-handed tactic, like a wrist lock or an arm bar, you would use an OC spray. So most police departments use it at a relatively low level of force. And it generally seems to work at that low level of force. It's once you go into the higher levels of force that it not only tends to fail, but it tends to make the subjects even more aggressive very often, and then it makes the cops react in a more aggressive manner as far as their level of force, because they've been told that this stuff works on grizzly bears, and now they have somebody walking right through it.
The company that produces mace is involved in a lawsuit brought against them by the Federal Trade Commission. Could you talk a little bit about that and
That's correct.
Why they were targeted for this?
Well, the reason why that particular company was targeted, and I hear there's a couple of companies that are actually targeted now, it's just I think they were targeted because they were the largest distributor of deterrent sprays, was because their ads were very misleading. Matter of fact, I'll go so far as to say their ads were downright dishonest. They were downright wrong. They would say things like, "This will stop the most violent attacker. This will stop. Someone will not be able to see after being sprayed with this." Just slogans like "Just aim, spray, and walk away." Things that were very misleading and led people to think that they were carrying a panacea with them, and that no matter how violent the subject, if they just sprayed him in the face, that the attack would stop. And that, in fact, is not the case. When you spray someone, even in a civilian scenario, when you spray someone, you had better be ready to follow up that use of the spray, because if that's a highly aggressive, agitated, or violent, or goal-oriented person, you just gave them adrenaline dump. And now they're stronger, faster, and more pain-tolerant than they were before. So if you don't have a backup system other than that spray, you're in serious trouble.
I've watched people being sprayed. I watched the activists being swabbed, and it seems excruciating, and especially to the at the extent of the use, because usually they're not just sprayed with one or two little sprays from, you know, 8 feet away or whatever the manufacturers recommend. They're sprayed back and forth, at close range, and swabbed directly onto their eyes, and it seems like that level, it actually seems very violent and tantamount to torture, which in Amnesty International's report, they actually condemn the swabbing of the eyes of nonviolent activists as torture. Do you
right.
have any comment on that?
Well, I believe that any technique, once proven ineffective, if it's repeatedly used, verges on brutality.
And are the manufacturers of OC sprays aware that their products are being used against demonstrators and protesters?
Oh, yes. I see in a lot of their ads. I see it can work against demonstrators. It'll work against passive demonstrators. It'll work against noncompliant demonstrators. And it'll even work against people on drugs. I see it. You see it on a lot of the various advertisements for different sprays. I can't remember what company put it out, but I remember a company even putting out a training tape, and in the training tape they were spraying demonstrators.
Phil Messina of Modern Warrior, a law enforcement training organization based in New York, speaking with Stephanie Welch. There are few federal regulations setting limits on the use of pepper spray. Many police departments use pepper spray as a primary pain compliance technique, acting on the assumption that it is less severe than a baton as a means of coercive force. The New York City Police Department, for example, uses pepper spray as the first line of defense in situations where substantial force is necessary if an assailant is being non-compliant, in other words, not responding to verbal commands. NYPD regulations recommend 2 one-second bursts directly to the face. When it comes to civil disobedience actions, these definitions become a little fuzzy. A striker or a protester may be technically trespassing or obstructing business, whatever the case may be, and could quickly find themselves being non-compliant by exercising what they believe to be their First Amendment rights. But does this mean that they should be subjected to intense pain, disorientation, or risk of serious injury or death? The line becomes even more blurred when alleged police misconduct is involved. This was the case, say some observers, during an anti-war demonstration in Santa Cruz, California, on May 22nd of this year. Protesters had gathered outside a fundraiser for Congressman Sam Farr, who had voted in favor of war appropriations to fund the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. Witnesses say that Santa Cruz police tried to arrest a young woman who was playing a boombox loudly. Some of the protesters objected and confronted police. The police started to arrest another individual, a woman who had her young child with her.
Her hand was twisted so bad that the fingers, her fingers were actually touching her forearm bent backwards, with the hand bent backwards, and the hand was purple. She was screaming out in pain, and the child was screaming out, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." There was a cop trying to take the kid away, and the whole thing was just completely unprovoked and very brutal. We asked the officer Lefevre to stop brutalizing this woman and to stop doing what they were doing, which he refused to do, and he just stood there. He just stood there with this woman, holding her like that, with the hand purple.
Steve Argue is an anti-war activist in Santa Cruz who attended the May 22nd demonstration.
This woman was being tortured. The child was being terrorized. I did what was necessary, which was I punched the cop and ran. And that did stop the brutality he was carrying out against this woman and this child. She was able to escape.
Argue says he had reason to believe that the woman was in jeopardy of losing her child to authorities. Next, the police went after him.
The first thing Officer Lefevre did right after he tackled me, he was on top of me, and there was absolutely no reason for it, but he, and it was against all police procedures, but the immediate thing he did was spray me in the eyes, from about 2 inches away, with pepper spray. And then he proceeded to grab my head and stuff the pepper spray canister in my mouth and spray it down my throat. Then a number of police had arrived on the scene, and they beat me. Officer Lefevre was beating me with his baton, and others. They were twisting and contorting my body as I had been laying in a fetal position on the ground.
In its report on human rights abuses in the United States, Amnesty International called for a full independent inquiry into several incidents where police used excessive amounts of pepper spray on activists. It said, quote, "The increasing use of pepper spray by police departments in the United States, despite conflicting studies into its safety, is alarming." Amnesty International called for an immediate ban on the use of OC, pepper spray, against peaceful demonstrators. As a final note, many activists say that pepper spray has been ineffective in stopping and deterring direct actions, despite its intensity. Like the participants in the Modern Warrior pepper spray study, who managed to accomplish their goals after being sprayed, activists stuck out the pain and remained committed to their protests.
They pepper sprayed me 3 times, and, you know, the 3rd time was definitely the worst. It was just this really intense burning feeling on my face, and also I couldn't breathe. And there was just pepper spray, like, dripping down my face into my mouth and stuff.
Carrie McKee is a 20-year-old environmental activist who was pepper sprayed last year during an anti-logging protest. She says despite severe pain, she still did not unlock from the shackles that bound her to other activists as they blocked a logging road.
I guess that they think people are more scared of physical pain than they actually are. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it doesn't work because, I mean, I would do that again. I'm not really scared of it. It's like they put it on you and then they tell you to unlock. And it's like, what's the point? It's still going to hurt even if you leave.
But that pain is generally additional punishment, according to Alicia Littletree of the environmental group Earth First. She says activists know there are consequences for engaging in direct action.
If we are protesting and we're using means, nonviolent civil disobedience, essentially we're trespassing. So, you know, it's our fault for putting ourselves in that position. And the argument, of course, that we say is, no, you don't give up your rights to not be tortured by, you know, engaging in civil disobedience. You still have your rights. Generally, we get arrested when we risk arrest in this kind of situation. When we trespass, if we go in and we lock ourselves down together like they were when they were pepper sprayed in 1997, if we do something like that, generally we're expecting to be arrested, and generally we get taken to jail and go through the process, which isn't the most pleasant process in the world anyways, and sometimes spend several days in jail and then go through the whole court system, which can last months, and we get our penalty at the end of it. It's not like, you know, we just walk. There definitely is a system that we go through, and it's part of the principle of our actions that you go through, you know, you face the consequences of what you've done. You go through the legal system and you pay your debt to society or whatever. But in this case, the police and Pacific Lumber Company took the responsibility of, being the judge, jury, and executioner, essentially, and didn't let us go through any kind of due process, and just basically, you know, we weren't even subject to a trial whether or not we were guilty of the crime. We just, you know, the people who were victimized by this were just tortured right there.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at pepper spray and social activism. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Andrew Thompson, who provided background information and editorial assistance. Stephanie Welch helped write and produce this program. Laura Levati is our managing director. Peggy Law is executive director. Our production assistant is Shireen Meraji. Norman Solomon is senior advisor. Our national producer is David Barsamian. And I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.